Aye. Sorry. And take and turn over to Revelation chapter 8. Revelation chapter 8. I didn't ever intend to make this series. It just kind of happened that way. A long time ago, we were in Revelation chapter 1 when I was here on Sunday night. And then I was like, well, there's something in Revelation 2 and 3. And then there was something in 4 and 5. And then there was something in 6 and 7. So now we're here in 8. So I didn't intend to do that. But I have enjoyed walking through this as we look through the eyes of the people in the seven churches of Asia Minor. Revelation isn't written to us. It's written for us. But it's written to the seven churches of Asia Minor who are going through a lot of persecution and suffering and pressure from every area of their life that you can imagine. Whether it's the government, who's trying to tell everybody that to be a Christian is to be opposed to the community and to be opposed to the king. Whether it was from their Jewish friends and their old community, where the religion they came out of, or those who are maybe just living nearby who are saying that this is the right way and you're going the wrong way. And whether it's their family who's decided not to be saved and not to follow this Jesus. And whether it's the fact that this is not just disapproval, but it's also persecution. They have to pay. They have to sacrifice just to be a Christian. He writes this book to them as an encouragement. And even though Revelation, the word encouragement, isn't the first word that we would think would come to our mind when we read this book, this is one of the reasons it's there. When Jesus appears to John on the island of Patmos, having been exiled, having been the one who's experienced a lot of this persecution and suffering for standing for truth, he comes to him in all of his glory as a reminder that Jesus is the king and not the ones who sit on the throne at Rome, not the ones who make the decrees and make the laws and shake their fists. Jesus is still in charge. And not only that, he holds them in the palm of his hand. He's not only is in control of things, but he cares about them. He gives them a message in chapter 2 and 3, and he tells them what they need to do better and how they could improve and how they can move forward, not just sit there so stagnated and so bewildered by all the intensity of the world that they're just trying to coast. He tells them a path forward, and then he looks into the future, which is what we're accustomed to in the book of Revelation. He says, now I will show you things which shall be hereafter. And he takes John to heaven. And John sees most of what we've been learning the last times we've been in here from the viewpoint of heaven. He doesn't see it from the viewpoint of earth, where he sees all the destruction and wonders what's going on. He sees it from God's point of view, knowing exactly what's happening. And in chapter 4 and 5, we see that Jesus is the only one who can make things right. Not any of us, not anybody in the world. And certainly not the governments and the people and the communities that were oppressing the Christians. He is the only one worthy to open the book, which is the sealed inheritance of man given back to him. But then he begins to break them, break the seals, open the book. And rather than things getting better, they seem to get worse. And he says, because he has to make this old world new by getting rid of the old world before bringing in a new one. We want God to make things right, but he's got to rid of the old in order to make way for the new. And so he does. And then we see in chapter 7 that he's sealing many of his own servants, many of his own people, and he has his hand on them. He stops all the destruction in the world in order to seal his servants. And then in addition to that, we opened up chapter 8 last time, and we saw that even though God is in charge, we are still, and what our prayers are to him, are still important, and they're still heard. Because all of heaven in a very loud book, all of heaven goes silent. They watch as a single figure takes a censer with our prayers and presents them in front of the throne of God on the altar of incense. And that is the center picture of all of heaven. Those embers from the altar of incense are then thrown to the earth to initiate where we are tonight, Revelation 8 and 9. Now, I struggled as I was beginning to write this, because Revelation 8 and 9 is what's called the trumpet judgments. Trumpets have a significance in the nation of Israel and in their history. They served many purposes. While they were an instrument, they also initiated a moment of importance, whether it was a call to gather, whether it was a call to war, whether it was to give a message, whether it was to announce the king, a trumpet would be blown in a certain fashion. And ironically, every one of those things is about to take place in the next few chapters. But all the angels prepare themselves to sound, and with each trumpet that is blown, a judgment happens on the earth. So I want us to read chapter 8 quickly tonight. We'll start in verse number 6 at the end of the section prior to it, and we'll read down to the end first. We're going to try to cover chapter 9 as well, but there's only a couple points I need to make from them. And so even though there's a lot we could talk about tonight, I'm going to try to make a few very small points for us this evening. Look at verse number 6. So the seven angels, which had the seven trumpets, prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all the green grass was burnt up. The second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. The third part of the sea became blood. A third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. The third part of the ships were destroyed. The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of water. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. The third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Now verse 13. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpets of the three angels, which are yet to sound. Very quickly, everything falls apart worse than it was before. That brief, pleasant interlude in chapter 7 is very quickly over. And everyone on the earth sees all this destruction happen almost immediately. There's a big conversation about how quickly these things take place, but it's fairly obvious that the feeling of Revelation is that these things are taking place quicker and quicker. Now remember, this is written to a discouraged church, or at least a church that is experiencing a lot of difficulty. This is written to them. Because these people, they're dealing with a lot of things, a lot of difficulty, a lot of pressure. And some days, when they look out into their friends and their families and their neighbors, some days, it's very appealing for all the people who live in the world. Well, maybe if I were like them, I wouldn't have to deal with so much. Well, maybe if I were like them, I wouldn't have to sacrifice so much. Well, maybe if I were like them, I wouldn't have to give so much. I could do as I please. And during those times, that society was known for debauchery and looseness, do whatever we want. And there are days when you and I, we look out into the world, and we know we're supposed to do what is right. We know we need to be faithful. We know we need to be followers of Christ. But sometimes it seems more appealing to be like the world than to be a follower of Christ. Some days are harder because we do what is right. Some days we seem out of place. Some days we seem peculiar, and it seems like it would be more enticing for the world to be our home. But here in these couple chapters, what he shows to these churches is that it is not better to make your world your home. He says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. And to a certain extent, we all make this world our home, don't we? That's because we live here. We drive these roads, we speak this world's language. We often can, although, get encumbered by this world's way of thinking, these world's decisions, the world's pastimes, the world's belief, the world's morality. We run around singing, this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through, and from Monday through Saturday, it's easy to make this world our home. He says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. The word inhabitants there comes from the word katoikeo. It's a compound word. The word orkeo comes from the word oikos. How many of you have ever bought Greek yogurt? And you bought oikos Greek yogurt. Yes. Oh, now you're talking. I know my grocery list. The word literally means house. So you go to the store and you buy house yogurt. That's what you buy. I don't know what that means, but just so you know, if it makes you feel better, now you know more stuff. The word oikos means house. So oikeo is a verb meaning to make your home. The word kot has the idea of being down, not just to live there for a while, but to settle down into, to make your home. At the end of this chapter, he looks down on the earth and he says, woe to those who have settled down here on earth. This they have made their home. You see, the very opposite is talked about the Christian. In 1 Peter, if you want to turn there, you can. Keep your place in Revelation. 1 Peter is just a few books back. In the book of 1 Peter, the common understanding of 1 Peter is that it's a book about suffering. And that's not wrong. Because there's a lot of talking about suffering in chapter 1, at the end of chapter 2. Then he talks about marriage, which we all know can be a very suffering experience in chapter 3. And so for that reason, I tend not to think that suffering is the encompassing theme of 1 Peter. Because how he begins the book is not suffering. How he begins the book is a disconnectedness to the world. As he opens the book, he speaks to those, verse number 1 of 1 Peter, who are scattered throughout the earth. This was at the back end of the time where they were starting to feel the persecution and they had to leave Jerusalem. And so some went here and some went there and some went there and they had to be moved from their place of residence, moved from where they grew up, moved from where they were used to. And then he refers to them in a positive way, verse 2, that they are elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through sanctification of the Spirit, unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. Grace unto you and peace be multiplied. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. To what? To an inheritance that is incorruptible, undefiled, that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last times. And so wherein we greatly rejoice, though now, for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, the trial of your faith being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto the praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Now don't go away from 1 Peter. But what he says to them is, hey, you are all blessed, all you people who just had to move from your home and go to somewhere that wouldn't kill you and stone you if you walked outside your door. You're blessed. Why? Because you have an inheritance. That's not going anywhere. And it's reserved in heaven for you. And so you can rejoice, though now, for a while you're here, the place where you don't really belong, you go through hard times. You can rejoice because some of those difficulties, some of those trials, some of those persecutions that you have to go through, they're making you more and more into the likeness of Jesus Christ so that when one day, when you see him, you will be pleased of what he's done in your life. Their focus is on their real home, not on where they just happen to live right now. If you go over to chapter 2. He applies this to you. And he says in verse number 9, your chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Verse 11, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. He says to be a Christian is to belong to a whole different category of people. It's to belong to a category of people who live in a place that they do not belong and belong to a place that they have not been. You are a stranger to this world. So don't live as a citizen of this world. Don't live as those who have made this their home. There's a reason why we wrote the song, "This World Is Not My Home." Because you have a decision today, don't you? With whether you will make this your home or whether you will live for your true home. When we see the world through God's eyes, it will be obvious that to live for eternity is much better than to live for here. So we have to ask ourselves this question. Are we an inhabitor of the earth? Is this your home? For many of us, it is. I mean, you've been on vacation for a week or something, and it's been like the third or fourth day, and you guys go out, and you have a big day, and you do a lot of things. You walked a lot of miles, depending on where you've been. And then at the end, you're really tired, and you look at your spouse, and he says, let's go home. And know what you mean? You mean the hotel. That's what you mean, because that means where bed is. That's what you're thinking about on that time. And then you laugh because it's not your home, but you just said it. It just kind of came out, but you don't really live there. That's not where you really belong. You're just visiting. You live for somewhere else. You belong somewhere else. You invest in somewhere else. This isn't your home. And so when you call it your home, we all chuckle because it's not. That's not where we're destined to be. And yet we treat this world as our final end. Not just where we think we'll live for eternity, but the end goal of all that we do. It is the purpose of our life, for here, to live here. And many of us have made this world our home, and we don't think about how invaluable this world really is. Chapter 8 and 9 reminds these discouraged churches who might look out their windows at those who seemed free, who seemed that they could do as they please, and they seemed to be suffering more. He reminds them that it is not a bright future for those who have made this world their home. So tonight, very quickly, hopefully, he tells us not to envy the world, and he's going to give us three reminders to those who have made earth their home. This is a letter to the inhabitants of the earth. So I'm going to give you those three reminders very quickly. Number one, if this world is your home, remember that it is only as good as God lets it be. If this world is your home, it is only as good as God lets it be. To make this world your home is to really reject that heaven is your home. To make this world your home is to really live for here instead of live for eternity. It is to do as I please instead of what God pleases. And yet, we forget about the fact that how good this world is that we live for is completely based upon how good God allows it to be. So in chapter 8, we'll be in chapter 9 in a moment, but in chapter 8, several things happen. There's a lot of observations we can make. I'll make a couple of them really quickly while we're here, and then I want to make a simple point. The one thing I notice about these is the judgments themselves. So the first judgment is that hail and fire and blood fall from the sky, and the consequence is that a third of the trees and the grass are burnt. The second thing that happens is that a great mountain, whatever that is, of fire, falls to the earth and turns a third of the sea to blood. It's possible that this is a specific sea. Some people have said it's the Mediterranean Sea. It just says it turns the sea. I tend to think that it's all of the sea, all of the oceans. It really doesn't matter, but a third part of the animals in the sea and a third of the ships perish. Third thing that happens is that a star from heaven, probably a stone of some sort, a comet, although in the next chapter, the star coming from heaven is actually an angel. It doesn't really matter. It's called wormwood, and it makes a third of the water bitter, and so many people die from drinking the water. And the last thing that happens is a third part of the sun, moon, and stars is dimmed. Everything is falling apart. And the first observation I'm going to make with this is I tend to take this literally, because if the normal sense makes common sense, then any other sense would be nonsense. And so if it says that a star falls from the sky and hits the earth and a third of the trees burn, there's really nothing else to do with that. The funny thing is, people who make fun of a literal interpretation all come up with different ones. So you have yours, I'll have mine. We'll stick with what the Bible says. If it doesn't make this, if it doesn't mean this, and then it means something else, then it could mean anything. And if it can mean anything, it truly means nothing. So I tend to take this literally because it's right there. So there's that. Remember, by the way, this is the revelation. It comes from the word, Greek word, apocalypse. That's where we get the word, apocalypsis. The word means to reveal, not to cover up. So if he's going to tell us what's going to happen, then he's going to tell us what's going to happen. He's not going to tell us and say, and now you guess for the next 2,000 years what I really meant. So let's just take it for what it is. This is besides the fact that many of these things, by the way, for all those who don't want to take this literally, many of these things have been prophesied throughout the Bible. The book of Joel says, I will show wonders in heaven and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The fish dying, that was in the Old Testament as well. Hosea talks about how the land will mourn and everyone that dwelleth therein shall languish with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, and yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. He says the same thing in Zephaniah about how the fowls of the heaven and the fishes of the sea. What about the bitter water? Jeremiah talks about that in verse 15, chapter 9, 15. He says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood and give them water of gall to drink. He even talks about the darkness in Isaiah 13. He says, the day the Lord cometh, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. The stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his goings forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. Jesus says something extremely similar in Luke 21, where he says that there will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars. So, though chapter 8 seems almost unimaginable, the Bible told us these things were going to take place. And so if it says at the beginning and it says it at the end, it's probably true. So it probably means what it says, that it actually is saying that these things will really happen. The second observation is that these plagues seem familiar, don't they? You have hail mingled with fire coming out of the sky. You have water turning to blood on the earth. You have the sun going dark. Does that sound familiar to any of us? It's supposed to. The book of Revelation is just packed with imagery that you're supposed to identify. By the way, you'll appreciate the book much more the more of the Bible that you'll already call to mind. It's supposed to remind us a little bit of a microcosm of this moment, all the way back at the beginning of the book, where Israel left Egypt, because Egypt was the world, and they were in charge. And as they sat on their high towers of self-sufficiency, and they looked down on the people, and Moses said, let my people go, and Pharaoh says, who is this God that I should serve him? And for the next few chapters, Pharaoh finds out the answer to that question. And in that story, as the plagues were going on in Egypt, those who lived for the world, the people who lived in Goshen, didn't have to experience them. And Egypt found out who this God really was. And so if he did it before, there's no reason why he wouldn't do it again. But the third thing that this reminds me of, which is the point of my lesson, this point tonight, is the plagues remind me not just of Egypt, the effects remind me of creation. Did you think about that? All of this just on God's world. So the first thing that plague comes, which seems very much like Egypt, but the effect is that all the trees and all the grass, or a third of the trees and the grass, are burned. Then the water, where all the fish were, a third of them died. The sun, the moon, the stars that God creates, a third of it is dimmed. See, God's creation, this is God's world. And this is not our world. In fact, it's almost funny how we even talk about worldliness being an opposition to God. We live in God's world whether we like it or not. Whether we choose to follow God or not, we live in his world. And when we seek pleasure outside of God, where do we try to find it? We try to find it in his world. And what we often forget is that this world is God's handiwork. So just as easily as God can say, let there be light, God can say, let there be darkness. And just as easily as he can say, let the earth bring forth herbs that bring fruit and grass and trees, he can say, let a third of the earth and the trees and the grass be burned. And just as easily as he can say, let the waters give forth life, he can say, let the waters bring death. We try to find satisfaction in God's creation, and yet we don't realize that we're relying on him to make it good for us. And it's only as good as God lets it be. Because by him, Colossians 1 tells us, all things consist. Those that make this world their home are stuck in the very strange position of trying to live in God's world in their way, rather than living in God's world in God's way. And even in their opposition to God, they easily forget the only reason their world has not fallen apart yet is because the God they reject is choosing to hold it together out of his mercy. But your world is only as good as God in his mercy allows it to be. And so the question then should be for us, based on the way you treat God's world and the way you live in it, would God have any desire to hold it together for you? This is what he shows these people. You live for this world. What if this world wasn't as good to live in anymore? This is my world, by the way. You want God to hold your job together, don't you? But many of us uplift our job above him. We don't have time for him because I got too much work. And then we're going to get mad at him if our job doesn't turn out the way. We didn't get the promotion. We didn't move forward. We didn't get the raise. Or maybe we lost some hours. Well, God, what is that? Well, you're worshiping his world, and God's holding this world together. You want God to hold your family together. But we will live in our family the way we please. And we will maybe even lift up our family above God and then wonder why our family falls apart. Because this world is only as good as God lets it be. We want God to make sure our schedule stays clear, but we haven't cleared our schedule for him. This world is held together by God. So if your life is not falling apart and he is not the top of your priority list, then you are counting the number of days that how much mercy he extends to us. Those who dwell upon the earth, those who have made this world their home, are realizing they are living on borrowed time of God's mercy, who's holding together a world that they're using as an idol against him. There is no reason for him to do that. This world is only as good as God will let him be. Number two, I'm moving. That's good. Number two, those who make this world their home. We're going to be in chapter 9, by the way, so we haven't seen this point yet. Those who make this world their home. Have I told you to turn back? You can turn back. Those who make this world their home. Now, I'm going to make the point, and I'm going to tell you where we're going with this. They marry their world to hell rather than marrying their world to heaven. Now, why did I get that? Well, I want us to read chapter 9 very quickly. So he says at the end of chapter 8, verse 13, he says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth." Now, why? Not only because of all the inconveniences of a third less grass, a third less light. Imagine that, by the way. Imagine that the brightest, sunniest day that you will ever have is two-thirds as bright as it was before. The world is gloomy for the rest of the existence of this earth. Everything is just falling apart. But at the end of chapter 8, he says, "But woe to you because of what is coming." Well, what in the world could be coming? So some people call these the woe judgments. They're part of the trumpets, but he says, woe, woe, woe for the next three trumpets that are about to sound. So the fifth angel sounds his trumpet. So let's read that. Verse number 1. He sounded, "And I saw a star fall from heaven into the earth." And this is probably an angel because he's given something. "To him was given the key of the bottomless pit. He opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. And unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. Now, unlike the first four, it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads." The seal that we saw in chapter 7. Those who were his people, who he set apart, where he stopped all the destruction of the earth so that he could set his people apart to him. Only for those who haven't been his people. Verse 5. "And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. Their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. The shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of a man. They had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. They had breastplates, as it were breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings were as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. And their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name is, and in the Hebrew tongue, Abaddon, and in the Greek tongue, hath his name Apollyon. One woe is past. Behold, there come two woes more hereafter. Now, let's look at the last one. The sixth angel sounded. If that were not bad enough, at least the other trumpet has got like two verses. They spent half a chapter on those. The sixth angel sounds, and I heard the voice from four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. The four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision of them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lion, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were likened to serpents and had heads, and with them they do hurt. Now let's pause there. We're going to come to the end very soon. Now, if I would take anything allegorically, I'd be more inclined to take this. However, once again, everyone who wants to make these things symbolic, which they might be symbolic, that doesn't mean they're not real. Everyone who tries to make these things symbolic always have a different answer to what they mean. And so I tend to take this literally for several reasons, but one of them is, have you ever noticed every time they try to describe a good angel in the Bible, it's not much more difficult to wrap our mind in than these are. Whenever it describes a cherubim or the likeness of the throne of God, it was kind of like this. And so if these are not real locusts, then I wouldn't expect them to be the same as I can have something in my world to attach it to. But besides the fact, there's a simple point I want to make with all of this. These judgments are intended to be of a completely different caliber than the previous ones. These do not represent extreme inconvenience on the earth, as the world kind of falling apart around them, but literally torment in these people's lives. These judgments are not for the earth. They are specifically for those who are not followers of God. Specifically for them. But this brings us to the point that I want to make. Hold on to Revelation chapter 9 in your mind for a second. And I want us to remember how the book of Revelation concludes, which only will mean something to us if we remember really a story that's been going all throughout the whole Bible. In the very beginning of God's word, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's like, well, did he make the heavens or the earth? What does he mean by that? And the fact is, when man and woman lived in the garden, God's presence was with them. It was unhindered. There was no sin. They could dwell with God. But when man sinned, man was separated from the garden. He was separated from the tree of life. He was severed from his presence with God. And so, we look throughout the next few chapters in the book, we look throughout the Old Testament, and the story of the Bible is a continual story of God and man being together once again. Man comes to the base of Mount Sinai and the children of Israel, and God tells them to build a tabernacle. The word tabernacle literally means a place to dwell. So he tells them how to build it, how big to make it, where to put everything, what to make it out of. And this was supposed to be the place where God could be with his people. Of course, sin had not been paid for. And so the tabernacle was more a system of walls and barriers than it was anything else. But God's presence could be with them, in a limited way at least. But that wasn't supposed to be the end result, was it? We weren't supposed to put God's presence behind a wall. We wanted to be with him again. And so the thing is, in order to make all this right, God had to cleanse the world of sin. He had to remove the barrier between us and him. And when Jesus came to this earth, he was God tabernacling with men. John 1:14 says, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us. Literally means to make his tabernacle here. And so we called him Emmanuel, which means God with us. But when he left, it was okay, because if he didn't go away, he couldn't bring the Comforter. And the Comforter would come and he would dwell with us and be in us. And so God looks down at his church and says in 1 Corinthians 6 that you are the temple of the Holy Ghost. God is with you. But even still, it's not the same. And we all know that. Because the story of the Bible wasn't supposed to make God's presence better than it was out right outside the garden. It was supposed to be where God and man can live together. Now, really quickly, turn to the end of the book. I don't want to preach a message on this because we're going to get there eventually, I think. Revelation chapter 21. When everything is done and his people, the ones who have accepted him, the ones who haven't made this world their home, the ones who are living for eternity, his people are with him. In Revelation chapter 21, it specifically says later on down the chapter, there is no temple. No temple. How can there be no temple? This is supposed to be the perfect place. Well, because we don't need to put God inside of a wall anymore. We can all live in a city. The doors can be open at any time. We can put a garden in this city, and any man can go in and out. And Revelation 21, verse 3 says this, I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. The story of the Bible is a continual story of God trying to be with us again. Okay, which means earth was not supposed to be your home. Heaven and earth were not supposed to be separated. The story of the Bible is a grand story of redemption, how heaven and earth can be made one again. And through this story, there is a way to a certain extent to have heaven on earth. This is the idea of the word blessed. It doesn't just mean to be happy. It literally means to live on a different plane of life, where the space between you and heaven thins as God's presence lives in your life. Where you don't put barriers between you and him. Isaiah 59, we don't separate ourselves between us and God, but God can be with us. But not for those who dwell upon this earth. Rather than trying to marry their world with heaven, which is the result of those who seek after him. What happens in chapter 9? All those specifically, this world is filled with people who are saved at this point. Many people have accepted him during this time of tribulation. They've seen the warnings, they've seen the visions, they've seen the destruction, and they turned to him, and many did not. And for those people who made this earth their home, they did not marry heaven to their world, they married their world to hell. So go back to chapter 9. Go back to chapter 9. He says in verse number 2, and opened the bottomless pit. And there arose a smoke out of the pit, and the smoke of a great furnace. The sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. This hell on earth was not supposed to be like the previous judgments that just made life more and more of a problem on this earth. They married hell to their world. Verse 4, it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass or green thing, nor any tree, but only those men, which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. The last trumpet as well. Go back to verse 17. Even them, I saw the horses in the vision and them that sat upon them having breastplates of fire, of jacinth, brimstone. Out of their mouth issued fire and smoke and brimstone. These are not good angels because good angels are not bound. They wanted heaven to be as far away from as possible in their life. And when you push heaven away, then you open up the influence of hell into your life. J.A. Sice once said this, as we are heavenly in our inclinations and efforts and open and yielding to things divine, heaven opens to us. He goes on, but for the sake of time, he moves on and says, and as we are devilish in our temper, unbelieving and defiant of God, and self-sufficient, the doors of separation between us and hell gradually yield. The moment we yield to heaven, the more the thinner the barrier between us and God, the more we see his face, the more we hear his voice. And we say that all the time. But the more we turn from him and do as we please, the more we make this world our home and not our eternity, the more we reject his influence, the more we thicken the barrier between earth and heaven, and the more we open the door of hell to our world. It is possible to experience hell on this earth while my neighbor does not. Just like it was possible for the children of Israel to live in Goshen while everything was falling apart in Egypt. And just like it's possible for these locusts and these horsemen to come on this earth and ignore all those who are sealed by God. The fact is, it is possible for your life to be falling apart because you're rejecting the influence of heaven, and for your neighbor not to. Some things are not just the result of this world and the things falling apart, and it's just the way it is today. Some things are the result of our choices, marrying our world to the opposite of God. And so two people living next to each other, one is tormented, the other one isn't. And they can look out the window and weep at all of those who have married their world to heaven, but it will not be their fault that that was their choice to make. It's possible to feel the onslaught of the plagues of Egypt while your friends live peaceably in Goshen, but this will all be determined by where is my home. The life of someone who makes this world his home, it can only promise them torment and death. Chapter in the fifth judgment, did you notice that? Specifically, it says they weren't allowed to kill them. They weren't allowed to. Out of his mercy, almost not, because they sought death and could not find it. What a terrible life it is where death is mercy. Because then when you get to the last one, it's almost like they were allowed to die. Now they had his permission to die. But you know, the Bible says to the Christian, the wages of sin is death. What chapter is that in, by the way? Romans chapter 6. Is Romans chapter 6 written about the unbeliever or the believer? The believer. Now, we put it into the Romans Road, and that's fine. It's not written to those who are not saved. Romans chapter 6 is one of the most important chapters in all the Bible about the decisions you make with where you yield your life. Because if you yield yourself servants to obey, whom you yield yourself servants to obey, his servants you are to whom you obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience under righteousness. He sets before the Christian life and death. And he says, why does he say the wages of sin is death? Because he looks at these people who are saved and he says, the only thing sin has caused in your life has been problems. It has only brought death. It has only brought difficulty. And do you really think that once you're saved, it's going to do less of that? The wages of sin is death. It's just the way it is. We live so cause and effect in our world today, in our language. It's like, well, who brings death? And that's not even the point of the verse. It's just, that's what happens. That's the result. When we put sin into our life, death follows. And we can try to blame it. We can try to blame God for not being more merciful. We can try to blame those around us for bringing it into our life. But at the end of the day, he doesn't give cause and effect. He just says, that's just what happens. Sin, death. And here, they had chosen it, so that's what they experienced. That's all that it could promise them. Did you notice, by the way, it names the angel. Abaddon, Hebrew, Apollyon, Greek. Now we can have a conversation. It's not a big conversation. I make everything a big debate. I don't know why. Some things are small debates. But there's a discussion about whether or not this is Satan. Is this just another name for Satan? It's a different one. You know what I think? I think it doesn't matter, but that's fine. You can think that. But the name Apollyon literally means this: destroyer. He comes to destroy. And the thief comes not, but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. And the more influence we give him, the more he destroys our life. The more we reject heaven, the more we open our lives to hell, and the more things fall apart. No wonder people's lives are falling apart. No wonder those who are entangled in the weeds of this life, like Jesus says in his parable of the sower and the seed, no wonder their lives are being choked out. No wonder those who set up idols that have eyes but cannot see and ears that cannot hear, they feel forgotten and forsaken. Because if God's not there, then there's nothing else to have but death and torment. Hell can only promise torment. It can never promise satisfaction. Sin only promises death. It never promises life. And this is not written to the unbeliever in Romans 6. It's written to us because he wants to remind us and he wants to remind those seven churches in Asia Minor, this is what happens in the world. It only brings problems. So do not envy them. And we get so short-sighted. We look out on this world and we envy them. He says, there's nothing for you to envy about them because hell can only promise death. I'll give you one more thing before we go to the last point. And we are deceived, by the way, into thinking that all we need to do is just get through whatever's going on right now. The locusts came and they tormented men 5 months. Just picture that for a moment. Picture the day on the news where you can see the aerial view of this random hole in the earth with smoke pouring out of it. So put a volcano in your mind, okay? Maybe that'll give a good picture. An active volcano somewhere, which is, it's pouring out smoke. And in the distance, you can see these little specks flying out of it all over the place. And now we have some close-up views that people have taken and posted on Twitter and Instagram. And we have these pictures of these locust things with faces and hair and breastplates of iron, and you really don't know how to describe them, but there they are. And then you hear reports of people being stung and people who are being bitten and people who are going to the hospital and they're in extreme pain and none of the painkillers can help them. And imagine that happened from now until May. That is a long time. But hey, guys, we just need to get through this. And everybody posts, we'll get through this together. And everybody changes their profile picture. I'm against the locusts. And we say, good job. And so once it's done, everything will be fine. But listen, when this world is your home, when one woe is past, two more follow hereafter. Okay, we're done. Now we can breathe and go back to the way things used to be. And woes always follow again. Our life is falling apart because we have rejected the influence of the Lord in our life. And so we're just waiting for this season to pass, thinking for the 18th time that once the season passes, things will be good on the other side. We're looking forward to the weekend because work is just so hard, thinking that Monday is not coming around the corner. We're counting the days till our hard times are finished and they'll be done. So we look forward to the divorce in our life once the papers go through, because then once we're single again, everything will be good. We live for the distraction at the end of the day, whether it is video games or alcohol, thinking that the woes of this world and the influence of hell will pass and that there will be peace on the other side. But God promises still waters and green pastures on the other side of the valley of the shadow of death to those who are his sheep. When God looks at those who are inhabitants of the earth, those who are going through woes in their life, he promises them that two more will follow. We live so deceived into thinking that everything will be fine when time passes. Everything gets fixed with time, and that's just not true. And so God can only promise those who follow the thief that he will steal and he will kill and destroy. And as long as we follow the thief who is not the good shepherd, then we can only look forward to death and destruction in our life. That's all that it can promise to us. Lastly, and we'll be done. You do not have to keep this world as your home. But many do. Many do. So he warns these people. Okay, he warns these people. Go back to verse 13 of chapter 8. So I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven. Some people say it should be translated eagle. Really doesn't matter. The point is, he flies through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the four other voices of the trumpets, the three angels which are yet to sound. Now recognize, John is in heaven at this moment. He's still in heaven. He's been there since chapter 4. He's seeing it all from God's point of view. And it says an angel flies through the midst of heaven. Now, our terminology can get confused by that because we think midst of heaven means through where John is, the midst, the middle of heaven. But the word that he uses here, midst of heaven, is actually one word. Not meaning the middle of heaven, but meaning middle heaven. When God uses the word heaven in his word, he uses it in a variety of ways. Sometimes heaven just means the sky, the heavens. Sometimes it means space, and sometimes it means the place where God lives. By him specifying that this is not high heaven, this is middle heaven, the point of that, the reason that's significant, is the angel didn't announce to heaven what was going to happen, as if they needed the announcement. It flew in middle heaven, where the people on the earth can hear, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. The only point I'm making with this is this. When the angel gives this warning, he doesn't give it to all the people who are safe in heaven. He gives it to all these people who have a choice to make on earth. And God warned them. So it wasn't like they didn't know. It wasn't like they somehow missed chapter 6 and what happened to all those people recently? I don't know. What's going on around here? They've been following all of this. And he says, if earth is your home, then woe to you. The fact is, God doesn't seek pleasure in that. The Bible says in Ezekiel chapter 33, say unto them, as I live, saith the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn ye from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel? God has given us his book as a cry from heaven to remind us that death and torment and hell and destruction are not the only option for life. You do not have to stay an earth dweller. You do not have to stay an inhabitor of the earth. Now, we already learned that in this book, many are not. Many had turned from their ways. But look at the end of this chapter. So we saw all of that. Go back to chapter 9. Look at verse number 20. Now, it should seem obvious that this is not the way to live. But when you say that, though it's kind of a duh moment, you would think that that would be obvious today, wouldn't it? People are living and there's no joy, there's no peace, but hey, the mainstream media said I'd be happy if I did X, Y, and Z, so I'm just waiting for that day to show up. And so we really think that one of these days it'll be better if we just follow what everyone told us to do. So if it's not obvious now, then we shouldn't be surprised that people live so counterintuitively here. At the end of all of those judgments, what do they do? Verse 20. The rest of the men, which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold, silver, brass, of stone and of wood, which neither can see or hear or walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. That's how that chapter ends. Everything falls apart. Certainly they'll get the picture. But I'm just waiting for things to settle down so I can go back to living exactly how I did before. This was their response. Even after torment, and even after death, and even after the destruction of their life, they did not change. Why? Because they chose not to change. Whether God expresses mercy or he executes judgment, whether God gives good gifts or he takes them away, the ultimate factor of man's destiny will be the choices that he makes for good or for bad. We somehow always want to pin it on God. Well, if God had done this, then I would have. Stop it. You know that's not true. Right. You made your decisions the way that you chose to. Right. The people who are experiencing persecution and suffering by following the Lord, they're going through that because they chose. to. And what he's saying to them is, if you experience life, it will be because you chose to experience life. And if you experience death, it will be because you chose to experience death. This is not God's fault. He gives you thousands of years of mercy and then several years of judgment, and the people make the same decision either way. So stop blaming God for what's going on in your life as if he's dictating what you decide to do tomorrow. He says that this is our choice, and we can turn, but many don't. Now, why do they not turn? Well, maybe because of fear. Maybe all the things going on made them fear the world more than God, but I think it's much more base and much more relatable than that. Verse 21, it says that they decided to worship idols and do all those things, but verse 21, neither repented they of their murders or their sorceries or their fornication or of their thefts. Even after their lives have been ruined, they look around them and say, but if I want to hate somebody, I want to feel like I can. And if I want to do witchcraft, the actual word for sorceries there is pharmakia, drugs. If I want to, because that was almost, one always went with the other. If I want to do that, I want to feel at liberty to do so. If I want to appease my flesh, I don't want to feel judged for doing it. If I feel the need to be dishonest, I want to be accepted anyway. And so they look around, their lives are falling apart. And they say, but I just really want to do as I please. And so they repented not. And so I will follow hell so that I can feel at liberty. And this is the draw of the world. Promises nothing, takes everything, and we fall for it every time. Everything falls apart. We see our friends falling apart. Their lives are under the influence of destruction and the destroyer, and we're like, yeah, but look what they get to do. In 2 Peter, it says that they promised them liberty, but they themselves are the servants of corruption. The wages of sin has always been death, and the life of those who have made this world their home have always been torment. Our hearts are so deceitful and desperately wicked that even after we've seen what it does to our lives, we choose this earth anyway. But I want us to notice something extremely ridiculous before we're done. Go back one more verse. Look at verse 20. So, door of hell itself. Now, we can have an eschatological discussion about that. That's not the point. The bottomless pit. It's more for colloquial sake. But the door of hell itself has been opened on this earth. And what have they done when they got there? They tormented them and didn't allow them to die. And then almost out of mercy, they were allowed to die. But look in verse 20. They were not killed by these plagues. They didn't repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils. I'm sorry. What? You mean the devils that brought them a fate that was worse than death this chapter? You mean the ones that hurt them? With them they do hurt. With them they torment. You mean them? Yes. Those. Because he says we can do as we please. And so we will lift him up for the sake of our own stupid flesh. That is the life of those who dwell on the earth. That is the life of those who have made this world their home. In their attempt to build their own kingdom, all they end up doing is lifting up the one who hates them the most and lifting up the one who is opposed to the God who loves them the most. In their attempt to build a life of their own, all they have done is destroyed the life they've been given. And so in this chapter, he looks down from heaven at those who have rejected the kingdom of heaven for eternity and to those churches who are in danger of rejecting the kingdom of heaven in their everyday life. And he says, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. So whether you're someone who does not know where he will go when he dies because you think this earth is more enticing, Or whether you're a Christian who has settled down comfortably into the sin-cursed world, you have to ask yourself tonight, where is my home? Let's pray.